questions? Nope, got to stay. Okay, first question on NAFTA. If NAFTA is so important, as you and others claim, when can we expect the President to actually expend some of his personal time and capital with Congress on this issue?
As all of you know, on October 4, 1992, during the presidential campaign, then Governor Clinton committed himself to support the NAFTA with supplemental agreements on worker standards and safety, the environment, and on safeguard against surges, as well as committing himself to worker adjustment assistance and to bring court reform, which would be helpful in that area, with Mexico's compliance. In each of those areas, he indicated that it would be important to implement these reforms in order to make the NAFTA not only substantively viable, but politically viable. The President made it clear in his speech on February 26 at American University that NAFTA was literally part of the chain I was talking about, the chain of agreements, which is going to grow our international trade and grow jobs here at home. He is deeply committed to having the NAFTA with the supplemental agreements ratified, first negotiated, then ratified by the Congress, and put into effect by 1/1/94. His commitment to this has not changed. As we reach the end of this negotiating process, with the help of Ambassador Montagne and his colleagues, we will then have a NAFTA with supplemental agreements that the President will go out to the country and support as well as advocate.
Another NAFTA question. What would be the political, diplomatic, and economic consequences for the United States and for Mexico if the NAFTA were to fail this year?
Well, I think the political consequences are quite profound, and I think that there are many here could talk about that better than I can. But the fact is, we're deeply concerned about what would happen to stability in Mexico, what would happen to the confidence in South America in those emerging market economies and democracies if we were unable to have a NAFTA with these supplemental agreements. Economically, I think it's clear what would happen. We believe that jobs related to NAFTA and the growth of exports into the Mexican economy, exports alone will result by the end of 1995 in about 900,000 jobs. Without the NAFTA and with these supplemental agreements, those will drop to about 500,000 jobs. I would suggest we can ill afford to lose 400,000 jobs in what is not right now the strongest economy that we have had in this country. So there are political consequences and there are economic consequences and there are certainly diplomatic consequences to the NAFTA not being approved.
One more on NAFTA. How serious a threat to the NAFTA is Ross Perot's opposition to it? And I would mention the fact that he's planning a paid half hour on television opposing the NAFTA. How serious is that?
There are a number of interests in this country, of course, who are somewhat skeptical about the NAFTA, even with the supplemental agreements. I would note on Monday, seven environmental organizations for the first time indicated they would support the NAFTA with the supplemental agreements under certain circumstances, and we welcome that move on their part. In terms of Mr. Perot, I would only ask him, what's the alternative? How is it going to be better in terms of U.S. jobs, in terms of border cleanup, in terms of growing U.S. exports, in terms of growing U.S. jobs without the NAFTA and these supplemental agreements than it will be with it? It's a question that Mr. Perot and others who say they oppose this agreement have not answered, and I think it's a central question that we will have to face.
The administration has apparently had a special relationship with the big three automakers. Why have U.S. manufacturers such as Honda and Toyota been denied this access?
First of all, other automakers have not been denied this access. Number two, I don't know what special relationship means. We hope we have a special relationship with every worker and business in America. That's what we're here for, is to grow U.S. jobs and to help our businesses expand and try to create capital and be able to compete in this emerging world economy. The fact is, we have met with the big three. Members of the administration have also met with other automakers, both foreign and domestic. What we're trying to do is to grow this economy in any way possible. As we talk about negotiating multilaterally and bilaterally and regionally and industry by industry, obviously, on an industry by industry basis, we meet with a lot of people, not only at the USTR office, but throughout the administration. We have a special relationship with the auto industry. They employ a lot of people in this country. We have a special relationship with the United Auto Workers as well. We're going to continue those relationships. We're going to continue to advocate for American workers and American business because that's in the best interest of global growth.
On China, yesterday here at the press club, the governor of Hong Kong, Mr. Patton, said that he had advised President Clinton that China should be allowed to keep its MFN, most favored nation status, without conditions because it was in Hong Kong's as well as America's best interest. Could you comment a little on the administration's plans on MFN for China and, in particular, whether the president plans to announce any new China policy soon?
Number one, in a couple of weeks, we'll have the final review of the administration. I'm sure the president will be ready to announce his policy. There are quiet discussions going on right now trying to make progress with China. We are also working closely with the Congress, and we want a united front on this issue. As you know, it's a daunting one. We have a number of opportunities with China. We also have a number of concerns. The concerns range everywhere from market access to transshipments to mislabeling of goods to, obviously, nuclear proliferation, human rights, use of prison labor, and shipments of missiles to the Middle East. All those create a situation where we want to make progress. We want to work closely with the Congress. We want to be careful in administration as they address the MFN status of China.
Levi Strauss recently announced that it would not do business with China and Burma, I think in China and Burma, because of human rights concerns. What do you think about this, and should other American companies adopt such a policy?
This administration, of course, has deep concerns about human rights violations wherever they occur. We're currently reviewing our GSP program in just that regard, and we'll be making some announcements in the near future with regard to violations of human rights and how it affects various countries' GSP, or General System of Preference, status. As far as what Levi Strauss has done, we only can applaud it. We believe American companies should take the kind of stance that their government has taken and should take with regard to human rights violations. And we would, of course, encourage American companies to be the leader in protecting worker rights and worker safety and human rights wherever they operate.
On that, we've had several questions on human rights. Maybe I can ask another. You could speak more broadly about the role of human rights in trade in general, and I guess more specifically, there's a renewal of the Generalized System of Preferences coming up. It has human rights provisions. Do you think that any of those need to be beefed up?
I think the current GSP law, which we have asked for a 15-month renewal of Congress, has sufficient and significant protections for human rights in it as long as they are enforced, and we intend to enforce them. Human rights is one of those areas of that is affected by trade or trade can affect that we need to address, along with competition policy, technology policy, environmental policy. For years, of course, global trade ignored a number of these issues, didn't see the connection in terms of domestic policies in this regard and how it affected international trade. Frankly, they profoundly affect each other. As we move forward into the next phase beyond this Uruguay round, as we deal bilaterally and regionally with other countries, we're going to make sure that those and other items are on the table.
Switching to Japan, the administration has pending review of its tariff policy on minivans. Several other questioners wondered where you stood on this, and maybe if you could elaborate also on whether you think it would be wise to increase the tariff to 25% through reclassification with the big three holding 90% of the U.S. market share.
Is that what is known as a leading question? I stand with Lloyd Benson on that question. So when you get a hold of Secretary Benson and he tells you where the Treasury Department stands, you'll find out where the USTR stands. Seriously, we're in discussions in the administration on that issue. The review is being led by the Treasury Department. That has not come to the NEC yet. There have been a number of staff-level and deputy-level meetings on the subject, and we'll be addressing it very soon. Obviously, the minivan issue is one that is complicated. It has a number of ramifications. The president took a very strong stand in the campaign and has made statements, fairly strong statements since then in press conferences, but that decision will be forthcoming.
That kind of leads into another question here about the role of about the role of consumers in trade policy. One questioner says that the trade law seemed to be directed toward protecting workers and protecting U.S. companies, but what is the role of looking out for the interests of U.S. consumers in the way you do your job?
To the extent that we increase international trade, develop more markets for our products, expand U.S. competitiveness, make our and our workers, we have more and more jobs for American workers, will expand our economy, and that's good for consumers. Consumers are our workers, are part of workers' families, and so therefore that is good for them. There are certain kinds of policies that we could enter into or that other past administrations have which would close markets, not expand trade, throw up barriers which are not good for consumers. And that's the kind of policies we have tried to put to one side as we try to open markets and expand trade. I think the European Utility Directive is Article 29 is an example of that. Rather than throwing up a barrier, what we said to the Europeans, we're going to impose sanctions. We're going to invoke them and impose them, because what you're doing is closing markets in heavy electrical equipment and telecommunications, two major markets, high value-added goods connected to high-skill, high-wage jobs. If you're going to do that, we're going to invoke sanctions, not to close our market to you, but for you to open up your market. That's what we want to happen. If the Europeans have restrictions in the broadcast directive, or if they put unreasonable subsidies into the agricultural program in the form of internal supports or export subsidies or variable levies or a cap program that has made them now one of the world's largest exporters of agricultural products, when before these programs went into effect, they were one of the world's largest importers of agricultural products, that distorts trade. That distorts trade. And what that does is hurts all of us. So what we're trying to do is break down those barriers, open up markets, expand trade. It helps the United States. It helps our workers. It grows our economy. But frankly, it is good for a global economy that really needs a shot in the arm.
You mentioned the EC procurement dispute. We've got a question about that. Will the United States hold further negotiations on the EC telecommunications dispute during meetings, I think they're on Friday, with President Jacques Delors of the community? And if the talks are unsuccessful, will you move ahead with sanctions at that time?
Is this where the schizophrenia comes in? We're going to impose sanctions in the telecommunications area. That's answer number one. Number two, we'll continue to negotiate after that with the European community with regard to their closed market in telecommunications. Let me indicate one of the interesting facts here, where their market is virtually closed to U.S. telecommunications company. The U.S. telecommunications market, in terms of buying central switches, is controlled 54% by foreign suppliers. We have a totally open market in this country, in sharp and direct contrast to the European market. We need to open that market. It is about a $13 billion market per year. It means a lot to, again, U.S. workers, U.S. companies, and U.S. consumers. So that is what we're going to concentrate on, but we will impose sanctions. That's part of the agreement we reached with Sir Leon Britton representing the European Community just a couple of weeks ago.
Again, involving the community, how long will the United States give the EC to implement last year's farm and oilseed subsidies agreements before reimposing sanctions, like Mike Espy said yesterday in Brussels?
Under the Blair House Agreement reached on November 22, 1992, the European Community had four obligations prior to the imposition of the Blair House Agreement as part of the Uruguay Round. One, an oilseeds agreement. Two, an agreement on corn gluten feed. Three, an agreement on malt sprout pellets. And four, an agreement on enlargement. Three of the four have been implemented, or we have assurance of implementation. The last, on oilseeds, is not scheduled to be implemented or voted on by the EC Council until June. We have been assured that will be done in June. Frankly, we have said to the European Community, if you do not want us to open up the Blair House Agreement, then implement your obligations under it. We think that makes eminent sense. You know, you can either pay us now or pay us later. The fact is, you could, if you want the agreement implemented, if you don't want the agreement, let's open it up. They've agreed to implement the agreement. We're happy that they have agreed to do so, and we assume by the end of June that will be fully implemented.
Thank you, Ambassador Kinner. We've had several questions on malt pellets, and I'm glad that you addressed them because I didn't want people to go away disappointed.
If you want, I could speak longer on the issue if anyone would like to talk about that.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. One issue that's been talked about a lot in the press, and I think also over at the White House, is the use of temporary quotas with trading partners that maintain closed markets to the United States. Maybe you could comment a little bit on that and whether this is something that will be tried out by the Clinton administration soon.
The term TQI, temporary quota indicators, came out of a report by our Acton committee made up of business leaders from around the country, which was a departure really for the business community to come out for that. They talked about temporary quotas, temporary quantitative indicators in critical industries. We have said we want measurable success. We want results. We've talked about mutuality of obligation and comparability of results. That's what we're looking for in terms of dealing with the Japanese and our bilateral relationship. Let me give you an interesting fact. In 1992, the Japanese exported about $96 billion in products to the United States. 65% came in only six areas: autos and auto parts, semiconductors and electronics, and computers and supercomputers. If you take those six areas and look what's happened to the United States in the Japanese market, you will find in many places, especially government procurement, that market is virtually closed to U.S. companies. We're trying to open up those markets. That is why we're having these sectoral and structural discussions with the Japanese, or at least starting to set up a framework for sectoral and structural discussions, hopefully to reach agreement on that framework by the time we get to the G7 in Tokyo. Let me bring that home for you and tell you what that means or what the indicators are. Let's take computers, both mainframe, not supercomputers, mainframe, workstation, and personal computers. We have 40% of the Japanese private market. We have 0.4% of the government, central government market in Japan. You don't have to be a genius to figure out we have a problem. And what we need to do is open up that market like the U.S. federal government market is open to computers from foreign companies. In order to do that, it's going to take some very tough discussions. But as I said before, if we approach these in a spirit of we are trading partners, we are allies, we are friends, but we have to approach these in a candid and thoughtful and fair and tough way, I think we'll get some results.
Here's a question on the House of Representatives stationery. We've gone some time without a GATT agreement, without a world economic catastrophe. Do we really need a GATT agreement?
Well, I hope we don't have to wait for a catastrophe before we enter into both multilateral, bilateral, or regional, or industry by industry agreements. That would be a tragedy if we allowed that to occur. The fact is, many of the European leaders, starting with Prime Minister Major and Chancellor Kohl and even Prime Minister Ballinger, have said the same. We need the Uruguay round in order to boost the economies of developed countries in order to lead global growth. The President has promised to lead that growth, and the Uruguay round, a successful Uruguay round, is part of that. If we can get a big market access package in manufactured goods and in services and agriculture, and then that will fuel the impetus towards a successful Uruguay round and get it by December 15, it will be enormously helpful to the world economy. Hopefully, whoever that member of Congress is doesn't want us to wait till the catastrophe occurs before we go out and try to find the horse that has run out of the barn.
Another question on the round. The interests of large companies are well represented in the GATT talks, but what will the Uruguay round do to help small business compete overseas and fight unfair competition at home?
In fact, the Uruguay round addresses issues that are very important to small business, especially in the market access area and also in areas such as audiovisual and subsidies and other concerns. I know that Secretary Brown is working very hard to promote the interests of small business in international trade. International trade, which used to be the exclusive province of large businesses in this country, now has spread not only to medium-sized businesses, but to small businesses as well. That is a major thrust of the Clinton administration, and we're going to pay strict attention to it. But the Uruguay round will be helpful not only to large businesses and medium-sized businesses, but to small businesses as well.
One thing that I know a lot of small businesses are concerned about in the round is what happens to U.S. Anti-dumping and anti-subsidy law in the round, under the round. Would you consider a deal with a community to just pull those two things out of the round to make a deal easier to get this year?
No.
Okay. Here's a couple questions about Canada. Are you interested in a separate steel deal with Canada that would break Canada off from the large complaint that's been filed against, I think it's 20 or 22 countries? Number two, what about beer? And number three, what about live swine? And maybe you can comment on whether the swine are eating the malt pellets.
We have a binational panel on swine right now, and it's under consideration. It's quasi-judicial, so I won't comment on that, even if malt sprout pellets are involved. That's number one. Number two, we have had and continue to have negotiations on what is known as Beer 1 and Beer 2 with Canada. I was in Ottawa and met with Michael Wilson, the very able trade minister of Canada, and we continue to make progress in that regard. With regard to steel, we are not going to negotiate with regard to the countervailing duty and dumping cases, which have been preliminary decisions which have been issued by the Department of Commerce. As you know, the countervailing duty cases, those decisions were issued in November. In January, 6 days after we entered office, Secretary Brown issued the preliminary decisions on dumping. We expect final decisions in June. Then there'll be an injury decision by the International Trade Commission after that. Our steel companies, who are not susceptible to our entreaties, nor have we tried, are not willing to negotiate at this point. We think the answer to this problem is not in bilateral discussions, but in multilateral discussions and trying to reach a multilateral steel agreement. But that must mean we discipline subsidies in such an agreement. We have got to do something about the pernicious use of subsidies in the steel industry. The reason is many-fold, not the least of which is we have overcapacity of steel production in the world, and that results in dumping. One of the most interesting things that's happened to, I know, Secretary Brown and myself, as we have listened to people argue both sides of this situation with regard to the steel industry, not one person has come into his office and my office and argue that dumping was not taking place. That's accepted that dumping was taking place. The only question was, what should we be doing about it? What we think we should be doing about it is reach a multilateral steel agreement negotiate bilaterally with Canada or any other country.
Question about Airbus, the European aircraft manufacturer. Is the U.S. satisfied with Europe's compliance with the Airbus agreement? What specific tightening of the agreement would you seek?
The agreement was reached with the previous administration and the community in August 1992. It's an agreement we're going to live with because it's an agreement made by the United States of America in good faith. However, we have no idea whether the Europeans are complying because they have not given us the information they're required to give us under the agreement itself, especially with regard to the Daimler-Benz purchase of Deutsche Airbus and how that works and how they're supposed to pay back the money owed by Deutsche Airbus. Now, presumably Daimler-Benz's obligation, how that's going to be paid back. We have a number of other concerns. We're still waiting for the information. Our patience is wearing thin at the moment. The fact is that agreement allows for subsidies of up to 33% in the development of aircraft. Unfortunately, that is the agreement reached by the prior administration. We need to have a multilateral agreement, we believe, in terms of, again, disciplining subsidies in the aircraft industry, as well as a multilateral agreement on aircraft in general.
On that topic, has the administration considered some suggestions of a countervailing subsidy approach to the Airbus situation that perhaps could be linked to the current commission on dealing with the problems of the airline industry?
Under the dictates of the agreement signed in August 92, it appears that that would be in violation of the agreement. And as we expect others to adhere to their agreements with us, we're going to adhere to the letter of our agreements with them. And so we don't believe that would be a viable option under the agreement as written.
Okay. Question again about the round. Has to do with non-ferrous metals and paper. Could you give us an idea of what U.S. goals are and what progress you've made on those topics so far?
On non-ferrous metal, on paper, on wood products, on construction equipment, scientific equipment, electronic equipment, medical equipment, we want zero for zero. That's what we're looking for. That's the best antidote to a slowed-down world economy, is to lower tariff barriers to zero, to increase trade and to grow jobs and to, of course, fuel the businesses not only here but around the world. That's what we're looking for. That's what we're discussing. We're making some progress. That's what we call a big or large market access package. We're negotiating in 12 industrial product areas right now. And in most of them, not all, we're getting very close to zero for zero.
You mentioned earlier the letter that was received from environmentalists this week, and I think you've said that a lot of their suggestions for a North American Commission on the Environment jibe with what you've been talking about so far. I'm wondering if you see that commission as hopefully some sort of precedent for a international commission on the environment that might be pursued in the GATT sometime in the future.
If we reach agreement, and I trust that we will in these supplemental negotiations with the Mexican government and the Canadian government, especially with regard to the Commission on the Environment, now called NACE, North American Commission on the Environment, we hope with the accession of Chile, with a successful NAFTA, will be called ACE, I guess, the American Commission on the Environment, that model will be carried over to some degree. Now, it may not fit in every instance, but the fact is what we're doing with the NAFTA, what we are promoting in terms of border cleanup and protection of the environment, will be inextricably linked to trade, and I don't think we'll ever have a trade agreement again where the environment is not an important and critical part of that agreement.
You mentioned Chile a couple times today. They hang very closely on comments about made by U.S. officials about their possibilities for getting into the NAFTA. Could you elaborate on what the administration plans right now, and in connection with that, whether you will introduce a bilateral fast-track bill to allow that to happen?
The president has said on more than one occasion that he would support the accession of Chile to the NAFTA once it goes into effect. We will introduce and support, of course, a fast-track bill for bilateral agreements later this year. We didn't do it in connection with our introduction of a fast-track legislation or to renew fast-track legislation for the Uruguay round for the simple reason we wanted to keep that a clean bill. We wanted no amendments. We didn't want to invite a major congressional fight over renewing fast-track for the Uruguay round. But we will look to introduce such legislation later this year.
Okay. I think that we're going to have the last question in a minute, but before we do, we just wanted to give Ambassador Cantor our usual tokens of appreciation at the club. Certificate, a mug from the National Press Club, and a special bonus today, lifetime supply of malt pellets. Okay.
Let me say I accept this. I'd also like some corn gluten feed if you've got any. Number two, under the ethics rules of this administration, I am praying this is under $20 so I can keep it. If it's not, Reggie, I'm going to donate it to the charity of your choice.
Thank you. Okay, last question. Clinton trade policy, who's in charge? You, Rubin, Reich, Tyson, Hillary, Sox.
You left out a few people. Left out Ron Brown. Got to put Ron Brown. You left out Bob Rubin. I don't know if you mentioned Secretary Benson or not. The fact is all of the above. We believe in inclusion in this administration. After all, we're Democrats. We didn't create all this chaos politically just because we stumble into it. We do it on purpose. Now, let me say one word seriously about that. This administration is more coordinated than any administration in memory in trade policy. There is tremendous cooperation, coordination. There's an awful lot of good work being done by Bob Rubin at the NEC. He's probably one of the most decent, bright, able, committed, intelligent people I know. We have great leadership in trade out of Secretary Christopher, Secretary Benson, Secretary Brown, Secretary Espy, Secretary Reich, Laura Tyson. The First Lady has not yet gotten involved in this that I know of, but we will welcome her involvement, obviously, and we even let the President involve sometimes.